Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00085. Recorded on June 5, 2025. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas. Information, Part 1. Skin Formation, Part 1. Chapter 85.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Recorded live before no studio audience, coming to you from the F-150 mobile studio somewhere around Dallas, Texas, USA. This here's Post-Harlan Monologics, and I am your host, Maverick 88. So what's up? What's up? Let me tell you what's up. What's up? Past 3 months, 4 months now. I've been on the new job around 3 months. A couple days from now, it'll be 3 months that I'm here. Even before I showed up for the new job. At the old job for a few weeks, 2-3 weeks, possibly more. I've had this situation. And the situation didn't just start then. It's an on and off kind of thing. You know, I consider it seasonal. I get it like 3 or 4 times a year. And I don't really know what spawns it off, why I'm okay sometime, why I'm not okay other times, right? It's this shit. It affects my fingertips. It's like this little miniature leprosy. It's called contact dermatitis. I diagnosed myself because doctors, you know. I did go to a dermatologist. He's a jerk off. And that whole shit show is like a meat market. I've never been to one before. It was just stupid, you know? And I've been finding more and more. It's like you go to doctors, you tell them what the problem is and what the solution is, and they just throw drugs at you, right? And it sort of worked out that same exact way. I got this tube of some kind of pharmaceutical cream that actually reversed the progress that I was making with some stuff that my wife bought for me, right? For months, usually it just lasts like 3 weeks, right? 3 weeks, it might go extend to 4. That's a bad one. Sometimes it's just a week or two. You don't know. And I'll describe it in a second. But, you know, I try all kinds of stuff. I tried, like, just hand lotion. I was never a lotion kind of guy. I never was. I never needed to be. It was never an issue. Like, I get ashy. I don't give a fuck. There's my F-bomb. I get one an episode, okay? I wasted that one. That was a waste. But, whatever, ashy, right? But just putting lotion on my hands because my skin is dry there, right? It didn't work. It just got more aggravated, worse. I read online that you put Vaseline on your fingertips. It's very local to the fingertips. It don't spread past that. But it gets both hands. It'll start on one hand, then it'll pop up on the other one, you know? Well, you know now. Anyway, so I read this thing, you put Vaseline on your fingertips. But the problem is you got Vaseline on your fingertips. Now you're like sitting there and you can't pick up anything. You can't do anything. So they say, well, put it on at night and put like gloves on, some whatever, you know, kind of gloves over it so they, it could just sit there all night. But the Vaseline doesn't really soak into the skin. It doesn't have any therapeutic quality to it. It moistens, but it's very topical, and it doesn't like penetrate. It doesn't whatever it needs to do, it don't do. So it don't work either. And then, you know, this wouldn't be a remedy. This is just like what I need to do to get through in life is basically bandage it all up. And what I had been doing was just, you know, we got this kit in the house, and I've been doing it even before, you know, when I was a bachelor and on my own, and this happened. You know, just get Neosporin because it's convenient. It's antibacterial, whatever the hell it is. And I would put that all on my fingertips and then wrap Band-Aids around them, you know. Sometimes it's just one Band-Aid going right around nice and easy. Sometimes you got to finagle multiple Band-Aids. I'll get into what happens in a second again. I should have done that first. I didn't. Well, hey, not a perfect world, and I'm not a perfect person. I am here for your entertainment and educational purposes only. Take what you need and leave the rest, as they say, right? But, you know, that doesn't heal anything. That just makes you capable of functioning through the day with this problem going on, right? And sometimes just time will take care of it. You do that, and eventually the problem will stop. Seems like it's working, but it really isn't, you know, because this time around proved it. When I'm in 4 months of this, it's not healing anything. This was a bad case. It may be a case that never, you know, just when it starts to heal, it kicks in again. I don't really know what's going on. This is the worst I've ever had it. And this is the first time I ever went to the doctor about it. That's how bad it is. I hate doctors. I can't stand them. Then there's this stuff called O'Keefe's Working Hands. They sell it at Home Depot and you buy it online, wherever, probably a lot of places. You know, for people who use their hands working, it gets all dried out and all that. It's good for that, you know, but it doesn't have everything you need to actually heal. But it starts working in that direction. It's good stuff. And what really got me over the top was my wife got me this vitamin E oil to put on the skin, right? And when I started mixing that with the O'Keefe's Working Hands, then I started to get results, right? Like the dermatologist, that prescription cream stuff was actually sending me backwards. Once I got going, you know, forwards with this concoction that I put together, and you know, my wife got me both of those elements of this recovery, right? The O'Keefe's and the vitamin E oil. I put them together, and my skin starts healing, right? I call in for a dermatologist appointment, and they put me off for like 2 weeks. And then when it was my time, they canceled my appointment for another 2 or 3 weeks, and I finally went there. But by the time I got there, I had figured this out, and it was healing. I went to that guy, and I started taking his stuff, and my fingers started peeling and cracking all over again. It was like making matters worse. And it's just like, this world sucks, you know? This sucks. Any bad thing happens to you, you got to rely on these jerk-offs that make a boatload of money, and their business isn't even about health care anymore. It's just, I don't even know. You know, I guess everybody, it's every man for himself out there, but it just sucks. I can't stand it. And it's gotten worse since the whole COVID thing started, too. Boy, that was a cash cow for a lot of fucking assholes. Oh, that's 2 F-bombs. I'm going to have to start editing. Wow, see, this makes me negative. This is a negative thing I'm talking about, so it brings on the negative negativity of the negativeness and all. And then finally I got this stuff. It took like 2 months to arrive. I ordered it. I read about it somewhere online. I found it on Amazon. Turned out it was coming from Bulgaria, right? And I don't even know what the hell it's called. I'll have to follow up with you. The writing on the box is all Cyrillic and everything. The only thing in English, it says Dr. Wolf's and then something or another. And I forget what it was. It was called Linola Fett. Linola Fett. F-E-T-T. Fett. Linola Fett. Now, that stuff I've only been working with for a few days, but you know what? That's put me over the top. I use that stuff once in the morning, once at night, and then I do the concoction, which is very similar concoction, I think. It's not exactly the same, but the O'Keefe's and the vitamin B oil during the day while I'm on the job, and wear gloves while I'm working with my hands, of course. Now my hands are almost normal. It's almost completely done. There's still a couple little spots that are peeling. Now let me get into what this is like, okay? I should have said that right off the top. What it's like, when it happens, there'll just be like a little spot of drying skin. Little tiny thing, a couple centimeters maybe, around. You see it, you don't think much about it. It looks like a callus, like my fingertips get calloused from playing the guitar, and it looks very similar to that. You might get an area where the callus kind of gets like a little hole in it, and the skin wants to peel off and flake off. So it starts like that, right? And then the next thing you know, it spreads bigger, and then all of a sudden there'd be a crack deep down, you know, like all the layers of skin just kind of peel apart like a crevasse, and it hurts like hell. It's like a paper cut or a razor blade on your fingertips, right on the tippy tip, and it sucks. You know, it burns like hell, and you can't touch anything, and the skin keeps peeling. It starts to flake to come off, and then it just starts peeling. Sometimes in big little swatches, but often just little piece by piece. But it just starts receding back, layer after layer after layer. And when you get to a certain depth of your epidermis, it just breaks apart and, you know, splits. And once it gets to that point, it takes like 4 or 5 days for it to all come back together. And it's all got to come back in reverse order, and you got to get all the layers of skin to heal. But before that happens, it spreads some more, and it splits elsewhere. It spreads to the next finger and the next hand. And the next thing you know, you're walking around like Edward Scissorhands. Instead of blades on your fingers, you got Band-Aids on your fingers all the time. For months living like this. It's a shitty experience. It started for me around 10 years ago in Tennessee. I don't know what it is. I read, like, what can people be allergic to cause this? Well, these soaps and these perfumes and these cleaning solvents and these other chemicals and this and that. And it got down to, like, metals. Like, it said people have nickel allergies. And I'm like, well, nickel? I play guitar. All the strings, most of the strings on most of the guitars are nickel wound, right? Some of them are completely nickel, some of them are just wound with it, like an outside layer. But as much as I'm playing guitar, I'm always touching nickel exactly with my fingertips. That makes sense. That's probably what does it, right? I bought stainless steel strings. I got to change out my Stratocaster strings. I just popped one of those the other day. But I'm starting to believe that that's not the issue. It's not the nickel. It's not an allergy to nickel. It just looks that way. Because as my fingers have been healing these past couple of weeks, right, I've been playing more and more guitar. And the more guitar I play, the more my fingers are healing. So either this is what I'm doing is completely mitigating whatever it is that nickel does to me, or it's something else. I'm going with the something else. I think it's something in old dust, right? Old dust. Things that dust is made out of, basically, what? It starts with skin. We're talking about skin, right? Your skin ages, flakes off. You shed skin, and it just flutters down like feathers into the world microscopically. You know, but it's all over the place all the time. And that's like a basis for dust. And, of course, any kind of just little dirt, you know, earth, mix in with it, and then all kinds of turd from critters, from insects to, you know, varmints sits in there, you know, carcasses, shed, like spiders that molt, you know, the pieces of what they leave behind, they break down, and all this stuff adds up to make dust. And then inside the dust, you got what's called dust mites, actual living beings, little insect critters that eat all that stuff, you know, but they shit and they die and decompose, and people are actually allergic specifically to the dust mite in there. So I think it's something with that. And because, you know, from the time in my life when I was really getting more and more involved at working with my hands, it actually started when I had the house in Wiley, but when we moved out to Tennessee, it went to a fever pitch. I was always working on something with my hand, and always with old stuff. I had an old pole barn in the backyard. Not quite the back in his back, but the backyard, right? And it had just a lot of stuff that needed to be cleaned out of it and moved away, and burnt, you know, old wood that needed to get burned off. And I turned it into a chicken pen for my black Orpingtons, right? It was pretty good. It was pretty nice when I was done. But there was a lot of work to do, a lot of clearing. And you're talking about something that was just sitting out there, left alone, you know, unused, untouched for decades. You know, somebody built it a long time ago and just let it sit there, didn't use it. So everything was just old. It was loaded with old, old dust, right? And you don't know, the mice, the rats, the raccoons, everything that would just kind of wander into there and shit and piss and do all the things that they do, you know, and make the dust that they make for year and year. And I'm out there touching it with my bare hands because this was never a problem to me. I don't care. I just go out there, grab anything, work, right? Never had a problem with my skin of any sort, you know. Never thought of it. Never even thought of it. But it started there. You know, all of a sudden, I started getting this peeling skin thing going on. And it would come, and then it would go. And over the years, like I said, I'll get it 3-4 times a year. And when I don't have it, everything is perfectly fine. I can go along without wearing gloves, you know? And then all of a sudden it hits me. So I don't know, you know? It seems like it could be nickel. It seems like it could be dust. There could be something systemic inside of me. It could be related to the stent I have in my artery for the heart from the heart attack. You know, I know my body's rejected that. This happens to people. You know, they have some kind of metals and also chemicals that they put on the stent before it goes into you. Either of those two, or both, can generate a systemic allergic reaction. I have to take Zyrtec every 2 days because I start itching like crazy. And it all started with that stent, right? I know it. Everybody knows it. I can't do nothing about it but survive it. And I hate that. I hate that. I hate to have to buy this medicine and use it all the time. God only knows what that's doing to me otherwise. Go to an allergist and they'll tell you, well, you got something that works for you? And I say, yeah, use that Zyrtec. Okay, then you're set. Well, how about fixing the problem? You know, how about stopping this thing? What can we do? You know, what's the path out of this? Tried it once. They just wanted to patch everything up. Doctors suck. Don't get me going. I'm trying to get away from it. So, you know, and it started with that. And then I got all this old barn wood, right? A friend of mine out there in Tennessee's mother was the next county over. They had a couple of old barns. One of them was an old tobacco barn, right? They grew tobacco out there. They would hang it to dry and make big, huge barns out of oak wood. And they had one that was from like 1890. And it collapsed not long before I got down there. And it was just laying there in a pile. And I found out about it, and I was given permission to just come in anytime with my pickup truck and just start taking as many boards and planks and stuff as I wanted. And I wanted that stuff because I was going to make things, boxes, picture frames, whatever, just all kinds of rustic stuff. And it was just perfect for it, you know, and I had my choice. And people wanted that. People want old barn. People do things with chemicals to try to create that effect, right? To make a false aged look on old wood like that, or any wood, turn any wood to look old. So I was handling all that stuff all the time, right? And again, you're talking 100 and something years of just sitting dormant, all falling into a pile and all the dust settling there, you know? So I was doing that. I was doing most of that with bare hands. There was a little kind of like precision work involved with some of what I was doing. You can't have gloves on for that. And that's where I start to get into the problems. Those parts where I just cannot, you know, get things done with gloves on the fingers. And all the work-related stuff. Like when I came here to this job, no different than the job that I had before. Really, any job, even office jobs. It's like whenever I come into a new place, I got to make my new space. And everybody's crud and everything is just left behind, you know? And this place was dusty, and all, like, my storage areas and my little office space and everything was just all dusty and needed to be rearranged and fixed and to throw crap away that was no longer necessary. This business I'm in, you have a way here of just storing up all kinds of crap. Like, there's a managerial reluctance towards getting rid of things that you don't need. And on it goes, right? On and on it goes. So dust. So I come into here. Now, this didn't start it. I already had it for a few weeks when I showed up here. But I have not gotten rid of it the whole time I've been here because I'm at that. And it's always the dust, the dust, the dust, the dust. But now I've been very vigilant for the past 2 months. Hyper-vigilant, you know, gloves all the time. Cream before I put the gloves on, you know, that concoction that I got going on when I'm home in the morning and at night. So anyway, this is, I didn't mean to talk about all this so long. I really did not. What's going on with me? Make my life just a little bit more difficult. You know, so it's like I got the work-related kind of stuff with all the old dust. And then in any shed and workshop, it just always is that way. Once you get the dust going, then however old it is, it's old dust. And, you know, sheds out in the backyard, open right to the ground. All kinds of bugs are coming in there. All kinds of dust occurs. Every time you open that door, there's a displacement of air that occurs. Dust kicks up, and then everything you touch is covered with that stuff. And now, old workshop, same way, same exact deal, you know. And my life is loaded with these things. Every day, every day, every day, I'm doing any or all of the above, you know. And it's work with the hands. And then, but the part of it I never really thought of, but it occurred to me fairly lately, was all, like, well, my guitar stuff. I got all these effects pedals, and I keep reconfiguring them. I'm trying to find a way to get my tone, and my tone is a multiple tone. I don't have just one tone. I have to have, like, four tones at least, basic one, because I got four amps that I'm using for my electric guitars, and I also got 1, 2, 3, 4... something, I don't know, electric guitars. I got 9 guitars all together, right? And so I get all these different sounds. That's kind of how I roll through life. But I'm trying to settle them, and I got all these different effects pedals and all these different amps, all these different guitars, and I'm always messing around with them. The effects pedals get set up on a pedal board. The pedal board sits on a floor. It accrues dust. I could vacuum, I could sweep, but the dust gets up underneath it. The dust gets into the Velcro. It's all attached by Velcro, right? I got this custom homemade one that I did a few years back. It's really nice, actually, and it's big. It's like 4 or 5 foot wide. Holds a lot, you know. I could stack it up 2 tiers, or I could just run it 1 across. And it's been effective for me, but it's going to gather dust up. And you know, when I'm moving, and then the pedals, they sit on a rack on a wall. When they're not in use, they carry dust. I'm not going to sit there and dust off every single one of them every week or whatever, like Alice Brady or some shit, right? I pick them up, they got dust on them. I put them down, there's dust on the floor, there's dust, and then I'm all the cables and everything got dust on it. Dust, 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 dust. You see what I'm saying? And then the Velcro itself. Sometimes I have to cut Velcro, put them on the pedal, lay it down. Well, the Velcro, you know, you got the two sides. You got the fuzzy side, and then you kind of got the sharp side, and they stick together. The sharp stuff will start to, like, work at the skin on your fingertips when you're handling it, you know, for too long. It's like a sandpaper, an abrasive. And then that dust, and I think that's what really kicks it off. That's a bad, bad situation. That's a bad spot. And then you got the whole nickel thing on top of that when you start playing afterwards, right? These things all may work together to cause the problems and perpetuate the problems. All right, so I got all these the effects pedal configurations and reconfigurations that I do. All right, you see just how constant the working with the hands is, the fine work with the hands is, and all the dust and nickel and all this, and it's constant in my day, and the result of it is periodically I get this contact dermatitis shit, right? And I've had no solution to it until now. I think I got 2 things going on at the same time, both of which work, right? One is something I could whip together on my own, and the other something I could order and wait for 2 months for it to show up. And it wasn't cheap either. I don't remember how much it was, but it wasn't cheap. You know, and then, you know, to top it all off, in these past couple of months, one of my amplifiers, where I talk about having all these amplifiers that I use, for the guitars, for the electric guitars, I have tube amps. I have three tube amps, and then I got one solid state. The solid state's an old Peavey, right? And that kind of works on my harp. My first amplifier was a Peavey Decade, called Peavey Decade. I was given it for Christmas when I was like 14 years old, and it was like a 1981 American-made amp, you know. And I guess to me, that's what an amp's supposed to sound like, because that's what I grew up with. Now, I've got Fender amp. I got a couple Fender amps. I got a couple of Marshall amps, and I've got a Vox amp, V-O-X. Those are higher end and more world-renowned, more versatile. They go back historically further, although PV goes back to the early 70s. It ain't nothing new. But anyway, I got this amp. It's called a PV Special 130, right? It's pretty bare bones. It's a 1981 itself, right? I bought it used. Got it cheap for like $150, something like that, $200 maybe. I forget what it was. But it's in that area. You can get these amps like that, but you better be prepared to work on them. When they're that old, anything can go at any time. And what happened with this amplifier was I'd be playing, and after about a half an hour, all of a sudden the volume would just kind of drop out to like a third of its power. What's going on here? You know? And I would just turn it off. I'd come back and play it again. It would start out normal, and then it would do it again. It would just kind of peter out. Well, eventually, it's like, you know, I had to look into it. I had to figure out what was going on. And that means you got to pull it apart. That means you got to look at the PCB. You got to look at the board, the digital, the electronics, and see what the hell's up. See if there's anything obvious to start with, and then start doing research, and then make a decision. Is it worth, A, getting it fixed by somebody and paying for it? B, trying to fix it yourself and buying the parts and finding the time, right? So I'm in here now. I'm tearing this amp apart, and this amp is from 1981, and I promise you, nobody else, it's a solid state amp, nobody else has been back there doing anything with that since it came out of Mississippi in 1981, right? So you got dust back there that old, and here's my fingertips. You can't use gloves for doing all that stuff, you know, some of it, but not all of it once you get in there. But oh, here's old dust getting kicked off. You know, they got the reverb tank in the bottom of the amp. I pulled everything apart, cleaned it all off, dusted it all down, wiped it all down, put it back in. But here I am with that dust again, that dust. And that's just another example of it, just something else in my day. I don't know if you all live lives like that, or just dust is everywhere, and then you start getting problems with your skin over it. But, yeah, so I got that amp, and I like that amp, and it was worth fixing. So I took the bother to figure it out for myself, you know. And I started working on it. Now, PV, if you're not familiar, P-E-A-V-E-Y. PV is a company, like I said, based out of Mississippi, right? Meridian, Mississippi, as it is. And like I said, they started out in the early 70s. It's one guy, I forget what his first name is, but Mr. PV, right? Mr. PV was just kind of like a sound electronics engineer type of guy. Started doing his own things and started finding niches in the market and built a company out of it that's now internationally renowned and has been internationally renowned for a long time. A lot of very famous people have been involved with PV through the years. We'll get into some of that maybe. But everything that they did that was made in USA until when? Right after 9/11, right? 2004, 9/11, the world changes, business changes. Oh, please don't get me started with that. But that was the coming out party for the neocons. The neocons are attached to globalism. And now you start getting this whole global type of organized global economy going on where everything is, manufacturing is all shipped overseas. And not just overseas, but specifically to China, and then secondarily to other ports in Asia, right? that started happening in 2004. And from that point on, PV had gradually but rapidly. First of all, PV held out from getting involved with that. The other big companies, they just jump right on board, you know. Gibson, for example, were already involved with production in Asia. All the companies were to some degree. A lot of places were making things in Japan and Korea, right? But here's where we made the big shift to China and the insane mass production of really cheap equipment begins. Right after 9/11, the larger companies were already on board with it. PV, no, I was going to give an example using Gibson. Gibson, their trademark is all made in America. You buy a Gibson guitar, that's American made. They have their lower line, Epiphone, that they bought out a long, long time ago in the 50s or 60s. They were competitors, right? Epiphone, known more for their semi-hollow body guitars and their hollow body guitars. In fact, I just picked up a semi-hollow body one made in Korea, right? Back in the 90s, which actually makes it better than made in China. And it's the second time I've had, it's an Epiphone Sheraton is what it's called, Sheraton 2. I had one of those previously that was made in Indonesia, I think, if I remember right. Not China, you know, and that was preferable. It's always preferable if you can get it anywhere but China, because China things are done different. And it shows, it ends up showing, 9 times out of 10. With guitars and all kinds of stuff. You know what I'm talking about. You're American. You've been dealing with this. But anyway, so Epiphone, everything Epiphone did started switching over to being Chinese made rather than, like mine, Korea made. And, you know, 7-8 years later, when they made my Sheraton, it was in Indonesia. And why that was happening, I don't know. But they only did that for like a year, maybe two. I don't know the exact history of it. And not everything was made there. Most of it was still made in China, but some of it was made over there for whatever reason. And then they stopped doing that, and everything is Chinese, right? Everything is Chinese. And they were doing that right away, I think, like by 2002, you know, 2002 into 2003. That was already in the works and happening. PV was trying to hold out and compete while still making everything in America, and it just wasn't going to happen. The business was going to fold up completely if they stayed that path. It's a shit sandwich, you know? And so they went that route, and when they did, they just went gung-ho. Everything is over in China now. I don't know if they make anything at all. I tried to find some stuff. They have some really, really, really high-end bass guitars that they make. They, you know, they're $3,000 and up to buy retail. I'm going to guess that they probably make those here, because I don't care who you are. You're not going to want to buy any kind of guitar made in China for $3,000. You're just not going to want to. I don't want any guitar made in China. I got a resonator, a Gretsch resonator that was probably made in China, if I remember right. And I got a Gretsch lap steel that was probably made in China. And I got a cheap Gretsch bass that was definitely made in China. And I got those. They're not primary instruments. Those are backup instruments for recording. In a pinch, if somebody's around, then we just break down and jam. They're there, you know. The resonator's good. It's an acoustic guitar, you know. Anyway, so PV is making like 98% of the stuff now that they do over in China. What I saw, like I was saying, they got these high-end basses, probably made here. Just, and I'm just reckoning that at a price point. And then they got some like electronic type of stuff they do, maybe like towards recording and systems, just quote unquote systems involved with the production of music. And I don't know exactly what they are. Those are thought to be made here in Mississippi still. Or that's just like the new kind of direction they're going with research and development and whatever's coming up out of that. They're just building it right there on site. But like I saw a documentary about PV and about this transition, and you know, they held up like half of Mississippi worked for them, you know. And Meridian is like near the border of Alabama, halfway up, you know, running north and south. And there's not really a whole lot out there. Western Alabama and eastern Mississippi, or it's all pine lands, and the people are few and far between, and the work is even fewer and farther in between. Meridian, from what I know about it, you know, it was a train stop town in the middle of nowhere, and it built up, and it had some kind of industry. I think the Navy might have some kind of base somewhere around there. If I remember right, a buddy of mine went to some kind of training there when he was in the Navy. Buddy of mine from the old days, right? He's up in Pennsylvania now. But anyway, PV started that company and they became world renowned. And they had all this production, they had all these people working for them, and they shut the doors on all the production, sent it over to China. All these people are unemployed. Now they got this big facility out there, big old parking lot. It's all empty. All empty, right? And I saw this documentary about just how depressed everything became, how depressing everything is, how upset people are. You know, people were banking their lives on working for PV Electronics, and all these promises were made to them, and all the promises were broken. It's like watching the U.S. government, the federal government, deal with the Indians, right? All the treaties. And then reneging on them all. Really a sad story, but there's nothing good about it. It's not like you had one greedy person that was ruining lives of people so he could have more and more money. There was just no business left if the guy did not comply with the global standard. And this is what the global standard is. It's a monster. It's just a monster that tears people apart, you know? Now, what? China's benefiting for it. But when the global monster changes its mind, now you're going to have billions of Chinese people tore apart, too. It's just, that's what that stuff is, right? There's greed involved, but it's not at the level of Mr. Peavy, I'm sure, you know? He's just trying to keep the business going and leave something, and then maybe the economics of the world will change, and then we could reel it all back in and make it like it used to be. I'm hoping that's the case. I like the PV equipment, what I'm familiar with, and I'm familiar with the older stuff. Now, the thing about PV, you know, they had become in the 80s and then in the 90s synonymous, like, with metal music, you know, heavy metal, hairband metal, new metal. Van Halen, right? Eddie Van Halen partnered with PV, and they made like a 5150 series, which is now spun off to become its own brand, not associated with PV. And those are supposed to be great, kind of high-end amps. I've never used one before. I can't really speak to that, but PV had become a metal amp, but before that, it was a Southern rock amp. Lynyrd Skynyrd was the big PV band in the 70s, right? And PV design, like customize the Mace amp toward Lynyrd Skynyrd's needs, and they made like custom model. Lynyrd Skynyrd had like these white kind of cream colored ones instead of the standard black PVs. They had these white cream colored ones that were real pretty, really different, really stood out. But they were for Lynyrd Skynyrd. They had an ongoing relationship, of course, you know. The kings of Southern rock are going to be with that Southern amp. They call the PVs the Mississippi Marshall, right? That's just kind of like a funny moniker for it, but that's, I guess, held up in time. So, yeah, it started out as a Southern rock thing. And it was really, you look at Lynyrd Skynyrd and other bands like that, they were using PVs and they were using Marshalls. That's kind of how they loaded out back then. Early on, it was almost all PVs, and I think they started mixing in some Marshalls along the way for whatever reason, or different musicians had different tastes, you know. But yeah, it was big with Lynyrd Skynyrd and Southern rock. And Southern rock, I've been back on my Southern rock kick. It happens every year or two where I just get back to my roots. That's my roots music. You know, when I started listening to rock and roll, it began with Lynyrd Skynyrd. It began with Freebird, and that's who I am. When you dial everything back and all the different avenues that my musical tastes have gone down, it always comes home to Lynyrd Skynyrd. It just does. All Southern rock, really, the feel for it, but Skynyrd was the principal in my particular case. And as a genre, Southern rock, how do you describe it? There's really nothing about it musically that's different than any other kind of music. It's basically rock and roll music, blues, soul, all kind of put together, you know? It's got the Southern elements that are cultural within the lyrics. I guess you could say there's a particular feel to it in general, because it was not really just Southern rock. It is Southern rock, but the core of Southern rock really come out of one specific area. There was a scene, like, you know, the grunge area. You had the Seattle scene, for one example. The Southern rock era, which was the 1970s, was Jacksonville, Florida. Jacksonville, Florida. Now, the original Southern rock band, by most accounts, would be the Allman Brothers. And they just happened to be a rock band from the South. They weren't really playing, quote-unquote, Southern rock. But the elements were there. They were really more of a blues band with kind of improvisation. They were an improvisational band. More like Lynyrd Skynyrd, in comparison, was a song-based band. They were all focused on making the song. And then they would go play the song exactly like it was on the album when you went to go see them. Allman Brothers would make a song while they were improvising something. They would record it as something like a song, and then they would play it a million different ways every time they were out, you know? It was a blues-based improvisational band. So there's a little difference. I mean, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Allman Brothers are not really the same animal. Some particular elements of Southern rock that are common are dual or sometimes three-way lead guitars. Right? You might have three guitars up front playing a solo at the same time, or two playing a solo and one playing a rhythm. But you would have multiple guitars, a multiple guitar attack is what they would call it, right? That's kind of associated with Southern rock. It's not limited. I mean, a lot of bands have two guitar players in it. But they're not often playing solos at the same time. They're not trading off solos. One plays rhythm, one plays the lead, you know? I guess it's hard to explain. You'd have to see it, but it's really cool. And it is. It does differentiate Southern rock from other types of rock. But really, what I was saying before, Southern rock is a Jacksonville thing, primarily. A lot of bands came out of Jacksonville. It's just like Seattle. You had all these musicians, and they worked together, played with each other. They mixed and matched parts. They would make this band and swap people around. You know, that's what was going on in Seattle. That's what was going on in Los Angeles with the hippie era, Laurel Canyon and all that. And then, you know, but the Southern rock thing was happening out of Jacksonville. Even though the recording studio, like, that was being used by the Allman Brothers, Capricorn Records, it was called, it was in Georgia. It was in Macon, Georgia. That was the kind of recording center for a lot of Southern rock. But the actual club scene where the music and the musicians were coming from was primarily Jacksonville, Florida, late 60s, early 70s. You know, all the Van Zants, Lynyrd Skynyrd was Ronnie Van Zant. Now the new rendition, we'll talk about that a little bit more. Johnny Van Zant's the singer, and there's a Donnie Van Zant. He was a singer I don't know if he was a singer. I don't know what he did. He played some guitar or something like that for 38 Special. 38 Special, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Molly Hatchet. The Outlaws? I think the Outlaws. Like, those are four world-renowned bands that came from small city of Jacksonville, as it was at the time, at the same time, right? That was the scene. And all the players from all the... And these bands were big. These weren't like trios and quartets. These would be like 6-7 players. They would have three girls backup singing. It was kind of a big production. So to have all these people to play all those parts in one town at that high level professionally, right? And they're all buddies, like kissing cousins, right? Really an incredible thing that I was too young to enjoy. I became a Lynyrd Skynyrd fan shortly after their plane crash, which really signaled the end of Southern rock. It lingered into the 80s, but it was never really the same thing, right? Their time had come. It was really a short five-year period, really like 72 to 77, something like that. And it was really based around Lynyrd Skynyrd. Lynyrd Skynyrd was the center. It was a centrifugal force of that whole genre, even to this day, right? Socially speaking, and I'll get into that probably later on too. I got some things to say about that as we go. But the Southern rock, like I said, that was my first music. That was my first rock music when I was a kid, junior high. And I consider me and my quote-unquote burnout friends to basically be extensions of Lynyrd Skynyrd. We were the same kind of people. We were the same kind of people, except we were from up north. But all of us, we seem to have this hankering for things down south. Whatever that means, you know, to a northerner, what the South is, the difference, how you differentiate culturally the regions of the North from the regions of the South, right? We wanted to be down South. And I don't really know how to explain it, but I could tell you this. Amongst my burnout friends, two things that are very surprising. One thing is most of us turned out to be politically leaning towards conservative, which you wouldn't figure from a bunch of drug addicts, right? And then on the other side of it, a lot of us moved down south. In this case, most people have moved down like to the Carolinas, especially North Carolina, but a bunch down to Florida. Obviously, I'm in Texas, and people, or, you know, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, people I knew and grew up with, partied with in high school, they made their way down south, a lot of them. Not all of them, but of the remaining one. I think about my brother. Man, my brother was as much of a redneck as Bo and Luke Duke as a kid growing up. That was his natural inclination. That's a dude that ought to be down south. He brings the south up north, you know? But he should have been down here a long time ago. I think he tried it. I think he tried a little taste of Virginia, which to me isn't even the south. That's kind of like the buffer zone between North and South. But, you know, when you're from Jersey and you go to Virginia, it does feel like the South. When you go from Virginia or you go from Texas to Virginia, it feels like you just went to New York City. It's just like that. So it's a pretty state. I don't mean to bag it. That's not what I'm getting at. But and that's a whole different conversation anyway. That's not where I'm going with any of this stuff. But, yeah, like the Southern rock, that's who we were at Burnouts. We all had these concert T-shirts, you know. Like I said, the Outlaws and 38 Special and Lynyrd Skynyrd. And then you had some that weren't from Jacksonville also. You had the, well, like I said, the Allman Brothers, who were basically a Florida band. And they were the idols of the Jacksonville people. And there was some kind of attachments there. But out of the Carolinas, you had Marshall Tucker, right? And then you had a lot of bands that I frankly never really got to be very familiar with. I think Louisiana, you had Wet Willie, who's really cool. And there's a band, what was it? Black Oak, Arkansas. From Arkansas, probably from Black Oak, Arkansas. And there were other, and there was bands that sounded like Southern rock type of bands, but that weren't even from the South. Like Little Feet was a Southern rock band, but they came out of L.A. I don't know how all that works out, but that's how it was. They played that kind of music, and it had a Southern feel to it, a lot funkier, but there's a funky sound that goes with that Southern rock too. That's part of it. It's not just straight blues. It's not just straight, you know, like Buddy Holly rock and roll or Carl Perkins rock and roll, but it has those elements into it. They're all, and that's the music that came out of the South, the quote unquote Americana music, all had that way of, you know, something creates and then it gets kind of amalgamated into other things and it becomes something new. Southern rock was like that. It incorporated a whole bunch of different elements and kind of came up with its own thing. And it's a good thing to me. It's a good thing to me, you know. It's rock with a country feel, but it also got the blues. It also got the soul. And it's not like, here's a blues song, here's a soul song, here's a rock song. No, they're all going at the same time. And it's all got that feel. And then it's got a lot of lyrics and passion and emotion involving things of the South, right? And I guess, genres of American music is not going to be specifically relegated to the music itself. The sound, the orchestration, arrangements, chord progressions, everything. All right, there's the music. That's one thing. But then you've always kind of got like the stylistic element to it that really turns it into something, you know. It just seems America runs that way. There's got to be a look to go with the sound, is what I'm trying to say. And I don't get it, but that's the way it goes. There's a lot of authenticity to the music because you got the country element to it. And country, really by definition, by old school definition, is authentic. I heard Willie Nelson call it, what, three chords and the truth? That's what country music is. That's a simple definition of it. So you got that authenticity, talking about like very specific stories, moments that happened, you know. And then you, as a listener, you relate to it and contemplate these situations, however your brain deals with it. I'm a head music kind of guy. I'm not a dancer, but that's part of it. It's like music that you could go to your head and party, you could drink to, you could smoke pot to, do coke with, you could dance with, you could take acid to. You know what I'm saying? The Southern rock just kind of goes right down the middle of all that. You could be wasted, you could be sober, and it's all good, it all makes sense. I wouldn't call it drug music. The guys who did it were all on drugs. But the songs, the lyrics, were as crystal clear and arranged and ordered to tell a story like country music does. It wasn't just all these vague references. You've heard me bag on bands like Radiohead, you know? The guy reads a book, some uncommon, distant relic of a book, you know, he finds something and reads it, and he starts making all these references in his song lyrics to this book, and nobody's going to understand it, nobody's going to relate with it, because they don't know what the hell he's talking about, and I guess it's being done for some kind of, like, intellect or intellectual factor, like, oh, look at me, I read this fancy pants book that nobody else knows about, you know. It's not relatable is the point I'm trying to do. And I've railed on that a couple of times in these podcast episodes. You want to relate. Me as a listener, I want to relate. And me as a musician and a writer, I want to relate with you. You know, it's both ways. I want that to happen. And other people think differently. And that's where you go from country into urban, you know. Just different mindsets altogether. This is, you know, working class music, you know. And working class people have a way of just finding a kinship with that kind of music. I don't care who you are. You could be an urban person. You listen to Lynyrd Skynyrd and it jives with you. It's very plain. It's a lot of going out to the bar and getting in trouble music. You know, who hasn't done that a time or two in their life, right? There's getting up and going to work involved, and there's heartbreak. There's falling in love. You know, it's very relatable. You know, it's grounded. It's solid, like I'm talking about. With its root elements attached so much to country music, you're just going to have concise, crystal clear lyrics that are, like I said again, relatable, right? Grounded, solid, reliable music. It's not so out there. I don't have to listen to a song 1,000 times. I don't have to get on the internet and chat with other people to find out what the hell this guy's writing about, you know? How come I'm listening to this song and I can't make sense of it? Like, I can't make it match up with anything I've ever had happen in my life or thought of. Well, because it's all so surreal and ethereal and drug-induced and trying to be weird on purpose and all that fun stuff, right? Not trying to relate. It's trying to hide. don't like that kind of stuff. I mean, again, Radiohead, I like listening to. I like the sound of it, the melody of it. If it was in a different language, it wouldn't bother me because the lyrics just don't make sense unless you know the story. And now I have to go and dig around to find out what the story is? No, thank you. No, thank you. I'll make it mean what I need it to mean. If it happens to be on the radio when I'm driving, you know? But I got that special 130 working, that PV, you know, for all the bother. I got it working again, and I got to tell you, that's my sound. Maybe it's because it's solid state, it's just reliable. Like I'm just talking about the Southern rock as a genre, the reliability of it. A solid state amp will just turn on and always is what it is. The tube amps, they're temperamental, they're moody. You know, the tubes, they warm up and the nature of the sound changes depending on how warmed up they are. Cold tube amp sounds one way. Middle hot sounds another way. Really hot sounds another way. And then you get different amps that have different characteristics and different speakers. And they all have all these different sounds and everything. So it's very temperamental. And then you start throwing effects pedals in like I was talking about before. Right? So trying to find your sound, something that just feels right to you, that when you play it, it makes you want to play more, right? Somehow with this PV solid state amp, special 130 from 1981, really old, I just plug it in. I don't even put effects on, right? It's got a dirty channel, it got a clean channel. I just play. I got that Epiphone. Solid body, Sheraton 2 from Korea in 19, it was either 93 or 95. Pretty old guitar. And it's got some issues. I did some work on it myself. It's really nice. It's really pretty. I like the sound of it. I like its range. I got a problem with the action on it. The neck has got a little bit of a bow. And I can't turn the truss rod to fix it, so I got to bring it to a pro that's not going to destroy it when they do it. There's tricks to get them things cranking, but I'm thinking it probably never was turned ever, and it's stuck in there somehow, and I don't know how to... I don't want to destroy the guitar. I like the guitar. I spent money on it, you know, not a lot. For an old, used guitar like that, what I spent like $500-some dollars. Not even American-made or anything, you know? But then I put another 300 into it to put a Bigsby on it, a whammy bar. And I bought the good American one for that. I like the guitar. I like the way it looks. I like the way it plays. I like the way it sounds. But the action on it is such that when you get like past the seventh fret, it's a little too high. It's not fun to play up there anymore. I could live with it because I got so many other guitars. I could do all those high notes elsewhere otherwise, but I want this guitar to be right, so I'm gonna have to bring it to somebody. Now I've been trying hard to just do as much of my own stuff as I can. I guess that's the Generation X do-it-yourself DIY deal. It's in my blood, I guess. I don't know, I don't know how to explain it, but we've always had to do shit ourselves, so why stop now, right? But I got it working. I did it myself. I got it working. I sit in front of it and I'm very happy, you know. I'm very happy.
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00086, Skin Formation, Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.